Then a set of notes for lesson 258. If you want to follow along online, go to gracelifebiblechurch.com. Click under recent sermons for March 16 and you can get the notes. So let's start this over. And again, I apologize, I'm not sure what's going on there. Okay, so introduction. Let me start over. Lesson 257, explore the historical use of italics in Bible translations, particularly focusing on their implementation before the 1611 King James Version. The lesson emphasized that the practice of using italics or other markings to denote supplied words in translations was not unique to the KJV, but was a common practice among Reformation-era Bible translators across various languages. So again, we saw that in French, we saw French, Italian, Spanish, we saw it in Latin and a few different languages last week in lesson 257. In the introduction, I stated that our aim was to provide a factual and balanced view of the topic concerning misconceptions about the KJV being the first or only Bible to use italics. So we did kind of address that. So those guys that are watching there, Nate, if they go to the church website, they should be able to pick it up. And yeah, so we definitely are not live on Facebook either, so I'm not sure what that's about. So let's just continue. So all told, we consider the following points in lesson 257. So we're going to ignore that. Whatever happens, happens online. If I have to redo this, I guess I have to redo it. I don't want to redo it, but I will if I have to. So italics, all told, we consider the following points in lesson 257. Italics in Bible translations predate the 1611 King James Version. So we saw that, okay? Number two, various Reformation-era Bibles in different languages, English, French, Italian, Spanish, Latin, use italics or similar markings. Three, the purpose of italics was to indicate words supplied by translators for clarity in the receptor language. Four, different methods were used to denote supplied words, including brackets, smaller font sizes, and Roman type in black letter text. So we saw different methodologies for noting added words. Number five, the use of italics in similar places across different translations suggests a shared tradition among Reformation era translations. Okay. By the way, that makes perfect sense when you consider the King James, that they say on the title page and elsewhere that they compared the prior English Bibles with the original languages, and then they also took into account about other foreign language Bibles. So that makes sense in that regard. And last, the inconsistency of italicization across different editions of the KJV challenges the notion of inspired italics. And I said we would get to that eventually, all right? So those are all things that we looked at last week in lesson 257. In the current lesson, we want to continue exploring the issues related to the use of italics in the AV. To accomplish this task, we will consider the following points. The first thing I wanted to cover today is some contemporary scholarly views regarding italics, and then I want to look at Scrivener on the italics. F.H.A. Scrivener has by far done the most exhaustive study on the nature of the italics, and he's divided their use into six different classes, and we will be talking about the first three of those later. Okay. So, point one, contemporary scholarly views. Professor David Norton, author of A Textual History of the King James Bible, is a modern scholar who rejects the use of italics in contemporary editions of the AV. Now, just because I'm quoting him here does not mean I agree with him. I'm just telling you what he says about the matter, all right? When he edited the New Cambridge Paragraph Bible in 2005 for Cambridge University Press, he did not include the use of italics. Page 2, here's what he says about it. Quote, "These," referring to the italics, "have been a perpetual source of difficulty to editors and a bemusement to readers. Few readers now understand that they are almost always an attempt at a scholarly guide to the relationship between the English and the Hebrew and Greek, de-emphasizing words that have no equivalent in the original language texts, but that are necessary in the English." Okay? So one of the points that he's going to make is that what italics, the use of italics has changed. All right. So if I write a book and I put italics in the text, am I de-emphasizing or calling attention to the reader to something that I feel is important? I'm calling attention to something that I feel is important, right? But what they were doing with these Bibles, and including the King James, is they're trying to almost de-emphasize and say, we've added this word or these words, and that's what the function is. So one of Norton's things is that the use and functionality of italics has changed from 1611 and from the 17th and 18th centuries to today. Okay, so let's read on here. Nor do they realize how much they have grown over the years. So he's noting the fact that the italics has changed in its usage over the years. The original italics were thoroughly inadequate, and a modern proliferation remains an ineffective guide to the original text for few readers who understand their intention. Strong's numbers, interlinear, and electronic Bibles are all infinitely better guides to the connection. So he's giving his opinion, and he's saying, number one, is the italics uneven across the editions? Yes. That's one thing he's saying. He's also saying that the modern reader would be better served to look at other tools than to just pay attention to the italics. And again, that is his opinion. Bemusing, inadequate, and ineffective, whether in the original or the current form, the italics only make reading more difficult. Again, his opinion. Besides tradition, the only grounds for keeping them, and then only in the original form, is that they are the work of the translators, but these are poor reasons. They are not part of the text itself, but a way of coding it for study purposes, and their only possible interest now is as something that might be studied for the very slight suggestion they give the translator's sense of the relationships between English and Hebrew and Greek. Consequently, they are not included in the New Cambridge Paragraph Bible, except as noted below in the margin. So what is Norton saying? He's saying that he doesn't think that the italics are benefiting modern readers. And so when Cambridge University commissioned him to re-edit the Cambridge Paragraph Bible, thus resulting in the New Cambridge Paragraph Bible in 2005, he elected to not even use italics at all in his Bible that he edited. Okay. Now let me just say, it's my personal, private, subjective opinion that I don't agree with Norton about that. I think if he's going to try to accurately reflect the text as given by the translators, he needs to do what they did and therefore use what? Italics. Okay. Put another way, Dr. Norton thinks they are a confusing distraction to modern readers. Part of the reason for this is because the purpose of italics has changed over the years. So not only has the purpose of italics changed, according to Norton, but also the italics is uneven in the various editions. And so therefore, when he edits the text for Cambridge, he elects to not even include the italics. All right. I don't agree with that decision, but that's what he's saying. Next, Professor Gordon Campbell also takes up the matter of the italics on page 190 of his book titled Bible, The Story of the King James Version, 1611 to 2011. He says, quote, finally, there is the issue of the italics. In the 1611 version of the King James, italics were used extensively and unevenly to indicate additional words supplied by the translators to render the text more comprehensible. In the first edition, italicized words were printed inconspicuously amongst the authoritative black letter type used for words directly translated from the ancient languages. There are many difficulties associated with the italicized words for modern readers, in part because the use of italics has changed. And then I bolded this. This is my emphasis. In 1611, the italics was to de-emphasize words, and now italics serves to do what? Emphasize words when you use italics in modern English. Okay. Scrivener valiantly tried to correct all the errors in the italics in the first edition, but the gain in accuracy may have been secured at the cost of misunderstanding for his Victorian readers. David Norton took the bold decision to not distinguish supplied words in his text, referring to the New Cambridge Paragraph Bible. The shedding of italics represents a loss in that a distinction that was important to the translators is no longer visible. So Campbell seems to be taking the opposite view of Norton. He specifically says that the not using the italics is indicative of a loss because the translators use the italics. Okay, so I obviously would fall more on the side with Campbell on this particular point. Okay, so next point. Campbell indicates he does not agree with Norton's decision to drop the use of italics in the New Cambridge Paragraph Bible, stating that it, quote, represents a loss. In the next paragraph, Campbell addresses the thorny issue of editing classic works such as the Authorized Version or Shakespeare. Okay? So, notice what he says here. So this is from page 191 of Campbell. He says, quote, these are not simple issues, and the decisions embodied in the Cambridge Paragraph Bibles can all be defended. Now, the Cambridge Paragraph Bibles is a reference to two different ones, okay? Scrivener did one called the Cambridge Paragraph Bible in the 19th century for Cambridge University Press. Norton does it again for Cambridge University Press in 2005, and that is titled the New Cambridge Paragraph Bible. So Norton is sort of building on what Scrivener had done a century before, all right? This is, however, a contrary case for a more generous... Top page 2, top page 3. There is, however, a contrary case for a more generous view of what constitutes the Bible. The analogy of editing Shakespeare may be helpful. Shakespeare wrote his plays in scenes. He did not divide them into acts. That was done in the printing shop. But modern editors retain the act divisions. Similarly, the list of characters were not drawn up by Shakespeare, but are nonetheless included in modern editions. Such materials together with the stage directions that may not be Shakespeare's are routinely included. It could be argued that a similar approach should be taken to editing the King James Bible. Okay, so what he's getting at there is it is a little bit of a thorny issue to edit these classic texts, right? And if a Shakespeare purist, for example, might say that you should not break into acts, is it acts or scenes? Scenes. What Shakespeare only did in one. Acts, and when you add these ancillary things to the text of Shakespeare, you're not presenting the text exactly the way Shakespeare wrote it or presented it, okay? Yet every Shakespearean play that I've ever looked at the text of, and in high school it was at least two or three, always retains the breaking up of the acts into scenes and all this, and there's always the, you know, stage directions and all that sort of thing that's included in all of that, okay? So, to be clear, I do not agree with Norton's decision to remove italicized words from the text. As we saw in Lesson 257, the use of italics or similar markings were part of the Reformation-era Bible tradition. I believe them to be essential for accurate understanding and comprehension in English. So, the scholars today are mixed on this issue. Campbell says they shouldn't have been removed. He views it as a loss, but does he acknowledge that it's somewhat defensible? And then he makes the comparison to editing the plays of Shakespeare, whereas Norton is just like, no, there's too much confusion. The modern reader is not benefiting from the italics being in the text. And so, therefore, when he edits the New Cambridge Paragraph Bible, he just doesn't bother to put italics in at all. Okay. So before we move on to the next point, does anybody have any comments or questions?
I would say I agree with that last point. I think that when you see italics, for a lot of us, it can prompt a deeper study. You know, if you see the italics, you're like, okay, well, that's not in the underlying Greek or Hebrew, so then you go to Blue Letter and start looking at the Greek and Hebrew and looking at the grammar and going, okay, why did they put this in here? So I think it does help. The student actually gives you a place where you can easily identify in the text, hey, here's something I got to study a little deeper.
So I would agree 100% with what you said, assuming the student understands what the italics is signifying. I do think, you know, Norton's not wrong in the sense that the function of the italics has changed from 1611 to today, but I do not agree with him removing that because I think it's a historical part of what the translators did, and I think that, you know, it's important to have that transparency in it. Any other thoughts about that before we move on?
Well, I think if you're a scholar studying the Bible, as you're doing now, yeah, the italics are important. But for the everyday Bible reader who is not a student of the Bible, maybe it would just be a distraction. For example, your modern Bible, any of our Bibles here, they don't contain the italics.
Mine does.
Yeah, I got a Schofield.
My Schofield has all the italics. Yeah.
I have italics.
What kind of Bible is that?
Well, mine just has footnotes.
Okay. Of italicized words?
What?
Do the footnotes tell you if a word was not in the original, or?
No, maybe it does have italics. I might be wrong at that point.
I'm pretty sure it probably does. Okay. You were going to say?
Like you say, when you're talking about removing the italics, the words are still there, right? They're just not italicized.
So Norton included the words.
So let's say and, he didn't take the word and out, he just didn't italicize it, right?
Correct.
Okay.
The word's still there, but it's not clear to the reader that this is a added word. I'm sure you have italics.
Yeah,
okay. All right, anything else on that before we move on? Okay, Scrivener on AV italics, okay? In Appendix 2 of his recently published book, The Text of the King James Bible, Dr. Lawrence M. Vance deals with the subject matter of italics in the text of the AV. In the context, Vance is discussing the use of italics in 1 John 2:23. Now, we'll look at this specifically later, so I understand there's an interesting case here, but we'll deal with that in more detail later on, okay? So in the context, Vance is discussing the issue of italics in 1 John 2:23 when he states that F.H.A. Scrivener is the only writer to offer a systematic analysis of the italics in the AV. Now, before we read the quote here, let me just say, so about 6 weeks ago, I went into some of the forums that I belong in Facebook, and I asked the question, who has the best discussion of the italics? And I got at least three people telling me it was Scrivener. So not only does Vance state this in his book, but other people have basically told me the same thing. I did receive some other information. I'll be mentioning that here at some point in due course, but Scrivener definitely seems to be sort of the industry standard on a detailed, systematic look at the functionality of the italics, okay? So let's look at the Vance quote here. The only detailed analysis of the italic type in the King James Bible is that of Scrivener in the Authorized Edition of the English Bible, 1611. He identified six reasons why the translators of the Authorized Version and its subsequent editions used italic type. So what we're going to see is what I've called six classes of italics, and I'm getting that from Scrivener, okay? Dr. Norton agrees with Vance regarding the importance of Scrivener's study of the use of italics in the AV. In footnote 16 on page 162 of his textual history, Norton states the following quote, Scrivener, who himself made a heroic attempt to render the italics throughout and consistent, is scathing of both the work in 1611 with his, quote, undue haste and scarcely venial carelessness. So Scrivener says that the italics in the 1611 edition is not well done. Now, remember last Sunday when we started by looking at that example in Ephesians chapter 1, that the 1611 did not have places in heavenly places in italics. And I said to you that it was not well done in the 1611, okay? He goes on to say, and in later editions where changes have, quote, been too unsystematic, too much to work of the moment, not sure what he means there exactly, executed by too many hands and too unsettled principles. So in other words, Scrivener's saying that this necessarily wasn't all that well done to hold out against hostile or even against unfriendly criticism. His detailed notes, pages 61 to 81, remain the only study of the italics. So Vance says this is the most thorough study of the italics. Norton is saying that Scrivener's is the most detailed treatment of the italics. Okay. So, Campbell, Norton, and Vance all acknowledge that Scrivener's treatment of the italics in the AV is the most thorough. Scrivener's coverage of this topic spans section 3 of his book, some 20 pages from 61 to 81. The section begins by discussing the historical use of italics in Bibles predating the Authorized Version. We covered this history and more in Lesson 257, where we cited the work of Christopher Yetzer, whose contribution extends far beyond Scrivener's regarding the historical use of italics. So Yetzer has moved the ball forward even beyond what Scrivener did as far as looking at the historical use of the italics. Okay? So on pages 61 and 62, Scrivener limited himself to discussing the Munster edition, the Latin Munster Latin edition, excuse me, 1534, Geneva editions, 1557 New Testament and 1560 Complete Bible, the bishop's editions from 1568 and 1572. Quoting from page 62, on the top of page 4 in the notes, Scribner writes, quote, "From these two preceding versions, then held in the best repute, the Geneva and the Bishop's Bible, the small Roman, as distinguished from the black letter, now and as early as the Bible of 1612, respectively represented by italic and Roman type, was brought naturally enough into the Bible of 1611 and forms a prominent feature of it, whether for good or for ill." So Scribner's saying that all these Bibles, have they contributed to the use of the italic system in the 1611? For good or for bad, this is what he's saying, okay? In the following paragraph, Scribner gives his opinion on the use of italics in the AV, thereby commencing his study of the issue. Quote, "One last point, namely the wisdom or convenience of printing different words in the same verse or line in different kinds of text with a view to the purpose explained above, is not necessarily for an editor of the authorized Bible to express or even to hold an opinion. Italics, or whatever corresponds to them, may possibly be dispensed with altogether, though in practice this abstinence will be found hard to maintain, or they may be reserved for certain extreme cases, where marked difference in idiom between the two languages, or else some obscurity or corruption in the original text, seems to forbid a strict and literal translation. It is enough for the present purpose to say that our existing version was plainly constructed on another principle." So he's saying, look, here are some different reasons why you might want to use italics. But these weren't the reasons that were adopted by the King James translators. Okay? "Those who made it saw no objection to the free use of a typographical device which custom had sanctioned and would have doubtless given a different turn to many a sentence had they been debarred from indicating to the unlearned what they had felt obliged to add of their own to the actual words of the original. The addition being always either involved and implied in the Hebrew or Greek, or at any rate being so necessary to the sense that the English reader would be perplexed or go wrong without it." So, Scrivener's acknowledging that adding these words does help who? The English reader, okay? "Taking for granted, therefore, the right of the translators thus to resort to the italic type and the general propriety of their mode of exercising it, the only inquiry now open to us is whether they were uniform or reasonably consistent in their use of it." So, I take Scrivener to be saying that you cannot... You can fault them for this if you want, but this is what they did, and they had reasons for why they did it. Okay? So it's best then to just try to understand why they did what they did. That's the way I understand Scrivener. Anybody have a different understanding? Okay. He goes on. "And in the face of patent and well-ascertained facts, it is impossible to answer such a question in the affirmative. Undue haste and scarcely venial carelessness on the part of the persons engaged in carrying through to the press the issues of..." We need to fix that. That should be 1611 in normal type, not in Roman numeral. I don't know how that happened. "Which are only too visible in other matters," see page 8 above, "are nowhere more conspicuous with regard to the difference in the type. If it be once conceded that the translators must have intended to use or refrain from using italics in the selfsame manner in all cases that are absolutely identical, and the contrary supposition would be strange and unreasonable indeed, their whole case in this matter must be given up as indefensible. There is really no serious attempt to avoid palpable inconsistencies on the same page, in the same verse, and those who have gone over this branch of their work will be aware that even comparative uniformity can be secured only in one way, by the repeated comparison of the version with the sacred originals." So what's he saying? He's saying if you want to check their work, the only way you're going to check it is if you compare the English text with the original language text to make sure that the italics are in all of the right spots. Does that make sense? Okay. This close and critical examination this close and critical examination was evidently entered upon with more or less good results by those who prepared the Cambridge Bibles of 1629 and more especially of 1638. For before these appeared, the italics of 1611, with all their glaring faults, were reprinted without what? Change. So, is Scribner saying there are major faults and issues and errors in the italics of 1611? Yeah. And he's saying it was the editors of Cambridge in 1629 and 1638 that were responsible for clearing up a lot of the faults in the italics. And he said before Cambridge did this, and he does flag 1638 as a year of particular improvement, he said before that, these things all just got reprinted without anybody what? Checking it or endeavoring to change it. And then he says, in the next century, by Dr. Paris in 1762, by Dr. Blaney and his friends in 1769, the rules to be observed in such researches and the principles on which they are grounded must be gathered from the study of the standard of 1611, exclusively of subsequent changes, regard being paid to what its authors intended rather than to their actual what? Practice. Okay, so Scribner noting the requisite difficulties with doing a study such as this. So, what are some of the things Scribner's pointing out? Well, in summary, you've got the fact that the italics is uneven. You've got the fact that Cambridge editors in 1629, 1638, they made changes to the italics, okay? Those things are indispensable. And thirdly, the way you're going to know if there was an issue is you have to take the English and compare it to what? The originals, okay? So, quote, "The cases in which the italic character has been employed by the translators of our authorized version may probably be brought under the following heads. In the language that Scribner, this is the, that line should say, this is the language. This is the language that Scribner begins his discussion of the italics in the AV. He sets forth six classes for understanding the italics, okay? So before we get into this, the classes, any comments or questions about Scribner's observations? Nate, I saw you scribbling some stuff down.
Yeah, I'm trying to formulate this question. It's more of a side.
Okay, so nothing yet?
Well, it's, so for the group that's saying you can't use synonymous terms in the scriptures because you're changing the words, would they also hold to that with the italics?
Great question.
And if they don't, if they're softer on their view of the italics, then they can't be inspired.
Correct.
The meta text.
So, there was one individual in particular who lives in the South who made a comment on one of our videos from last August or September and said, well, you know, what is your view on the italics being inspired?
Right.
And I knew that the question was something of a setup, so I didn't answer it. I just said, well, if you would have liked to talk about this, we could have talked on the phone and left it at that, okay? Because I knew that if I answered that question publicly at that time, that question was being answered to sort of set me up, right?
Right.
So that's a huge problem. It's a huge problem for that view that this italics is so varied, okay? And like we saw in the video from the guy a couple weeks ago, remember I showed you the clip from the guy, and he's talking about how the handwritten manuscripts of the translators that they hand to the printer, those are perfect. Word for word perfect. It's these dumb printers that mess stuff up. And remember I made the point, well, if God can make sure that what they write by hand is perfectly done, he certainly is capable of making sure that typesetters lay out pages perfectly. Like if he can do one, can he do the other? Okay, so they want to excuse everything away as all printer errors when they believe in perfect manuscripts coming from the hands of the translators to the printers themselves. Okay, so yeah, I think it's a major problem for some of the standard talking points. Did you want to follow up on that, or am I not understanding?
No, that's the gist of it.
Okay. So because we had the problem at the beginning, we're going to get through as many of these as we can, looking at the different classes. But let's talk about class one, okay? So class one, Scrivener's first class is stated as follows. So this is what he says in his book. When words quite or nearly necessary to complete the sense of the sacred writers have been introduced into the text from parallel places of Scripture. Okay? So what would a parallel place be? Like a cross-reference, right? So 2 Samuel talks about something, and then 2 Chronicles talks about the same thing, is an example here. Or 1 Chronicles or something like that. Okay? So in other words, one of the texts doesn't have those words in it. The other one does. And so what the translators do is they supply the missing words in italics to the first instance to make it harmonize with the other verse later on in the parallel place that has those words what? In it. So let's look at this, okay? He then goes on to provide multiple examples from the book of 2 Samuel. Please note that I have annotated this quote to include screenshots of the relevant examples as well as editorial comments in the brackets. Okay, so let's look at the first one here, all right? So we've got 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 8, okay? Then notice what Scrivener says about this. And David said on that day, whosoever getteth up to the gutter and smiteth the Jebusites and the lame and the blind, italics, that are hated of David's soul, he shall be chief and captain, italics. But notice what he says. The last clause is supplied from 1 Chronicles chapter 11, verse 6. Okay? So let's look at this. So this is a screenshot from the standard folio edition of Blaney from 1769. And notice what I've got underlined here. This entire phrase is all in one. Italics. Okay? So we're not talking about the word that. We're talking about this last clause being in italics, okay? Where it says, he shall be chief and what? Mm-hmm. And captain, okay? So let's go to Blue Letter Bible. Blue Letter Bible, and we want 2 Samuel 5:8. I spelled Samuel wrong, and of course it won't find it. Just gotta love tech. Oh, get rid of this. Give me this. All right, what? One more time.
2 Samuel 5:8.
Okay. Now, everybody look in your Bibles. Is that italics? He shall be captain and chief and captain?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. So I'm going to turn the interlinear on. Now, it's really important. We're going to go deep on one of these examples so that you guys can see what's going on here. Okay? So I'm in the interlinear now on Blue Letter Bible. And here, notice this phrase right here. It's in brackets. He shall be chief and captain. And notice, is there any corresponding Hebrew word here?
No.
No. So the reason this is in italics is because there's no corresponding what?
Hebrew
word. Does everybody understand that? Okay, so let's go back to the notes. And let's look now at 1 Chronicles 11:6. And David said, whosoever smiteth the Jebusites first shall be chief and captain. So Joab was the son of Zariah and went up first and was what?
Chief.
And notice also here, chief and what? Captain. I don't have it underlined. I probably should underline it, right? But the reason I don't have it underlined is because if you look at Scrivener, okay, so notice that in 1 Chronicles 11:6, it has chief and captain, and then down here it says, and was what? Chief. Okay, is any of this in italics? In 1 Chronicles, is any of it in italics? No. Okay, so let's go to 1 Chronicles. And it's, what is it again?
11:6.
Okay, so here's the verse. Okay, notice none of it's in what?
Italics.
So I'm going to turn the interlinear on. And notice when we get into stuff about chief and captain, here's chief and captain. Are there corresponding Hebrew words?
Yes.
So the reason they're not in italics here is because there are their corresponding Hebrew words here. Okay, so what Scrivener is saying, so let's go back to the notes. What Scrivener is saying is that the reason, so this is inserted here in italics. So I'm in 2 Samuel 5:8. Does it insert this phrase in italics? Did I show you it's not in the Hebrew? So what Scrivener is saying is that they add the italics here to this verse to make it correspond to the parallel verse in 1 Chronicles what?
11:6.
1 Chronicles 11:6. So he's saying the first class in which the italics is used by the King James translators is where you have missing words in one verse that are added to that verse to make that verse line up with a parallel what? Verse. And so what they do is they put those words in italics so that the reader knows that those words are not in the underlying Hebrew text. So this is class one example of the use of italics by the King James translators. So before we go any further, does everybody understand what I just said?
Well, it really means that they're there, but they're not really there. Correct?
Well, what it means...
Because if it falls underneath... Like I was just reading that Revelations 21. If you add to the Bible, they're going to give you the plagues. So that does not consist with that, because if you're adding to the Bible, that it tells you right there. You add.
So
to the Bible.
the reason why most KJV advocates would say that this does not fit the criteria of what Revelation 22 is talking about. It's because of the way they put it in here, they're telling you that they're saying, we're giving you these words
right,
so that you understand what's going on when you consider also the parallel what? The parallel passage.
Right.
Okay. But they're coding it by having it in italics. So, again, this is what the debate is in modern times, right? A modern reader who doesn't understand the use of italics might come to this verse and think that they're trying to emphasize this, when that's not what italics were being used for in the early 17th century. They were being used to de-emphasize this and say, we're giving you these words even though we know they're not where?
There.
Okay? So let's look at the bracket. I do have a bracket here at the top of page 6. Okay? The underlined italicized phrase in 2 Samuel 5:8 was not in italics in the 1611 edition. Okay, so let's look at a 1611. So I'm spending more time on this first one so that we can move a little bit quicker on some of the other ones. So 2 Samuel chapter what? 5 verse 8. Second Samuel chapter 5 verse 8. Why did I say that? Apparently that's a mistake. Because it is in italics. See, he shall be chief in what? Captain. So we need to strike that from the notes. That's a mistake. I don't know why I said that. I don't know what I was looking at when I said that. But Scrivener's suggesting that these words were italicized for two reasons. So that first sentence there, we need to get rid of it. The underlined italicized phrase in Psalm and 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 8 is not in the italics. That's an incorrect statement. It is in the italics. I don't know why I even said that, because when I look at it, it's there. This is a 1611. Here's verse 8. He shall be chief and captain. Isn't that the corresponding phrase? Yeah. So I was wrong about that. I don't know why I said that. I apologize for that mistake. But look at the next part. Scrivener is suggesting that these words were italicized for two reasons. Okay? Number one, there are no corresponding words in the Hebrew, which I showed you. And number two, they were meant to harmonize the verse with a parallel verse in 1 Chronicles chapter 11, verse 6. That's what he's saying. So he's saying class one of the use of italics by the translators is when these criteria are in play. Does everybody understand? Here's another one. 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 6. And when they were come to Nocon's threshing floor, Uzzah put forth his hand to the ark of God, rather his hand, as in 1638, from 1 Chronicles chapter 13, verse 9. So notice, here's 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 6, and is his hand in italics? Yes. Okay? If you go to the parallel passage in 1 Chronicles chapter 13, verse 9, Uzzah put forth his hand. Here it is not in what? Okay. Italics. So this is another category where if we look at 2 Samuel 6:6, we see italics being used, where a parallel passage talking about the same thing in the same context, it says his hand, but his hand is not in what?
Yeah.
Italics. So class one again for Scrivener is when you are doing this type of paralleling of things. Okay. Now, this time let's go back to the 1611. I might have got confused on these examples. I'm telling you guys, if you ever want to have an exercise in trying to not go cross-eyed, spend 10 minutes trying to look at this stuff. Now, notice here the 1611. Verse 6. Uzzah put forth his hand. His is not in what? Italics. Only what is?
Hand.
If you look at the standard 1769 text, both are what? His and hand are what? In italics. Okay? So here's another instance of uneven italicization. So I messed up in the previous point, and this one I got it right. So I apologize for that mistake. So if you look at the notes right here, notice in the bracket, the 1611 read his hand, his not in italics, hand in italics, in 2 Samuel 6:6. The 1638 Cambridge Folio H523 read his hand in this verse. So where do they correct the italics in this case? They correct it in the 1638 Cambridge what? Folio. As far as I know, maybe there was one before that I haven't looked at that has made that correction. But we know that appears for the first time. The first known appearance of that is in the 1638 Cambridge Folio. Okay? Let's go to page 7. So does everybody understand this first class? Okay, page 7, we got another example from 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 4. Okay, and David took him 1,000 chariots and 700 horsemen and 20,000 footmen. Okay, we derive chariots from 1 Chronicles chapter, let me see my Roman numerals here, 18, verse 4. So here it is, okay. Notice, chariots, 1769 text is in italics. In 2 Samuel 8, 4, if you look at a parallel verse, parallel passage, same context, in 1 Chronicles chapter 18, verse 4, chariots is in the text, but it's not in what? Italics. So again, Scrivener's first class is when italics are provided to represent words that are not in the original languages, in this case Hebrew, but appear in a parallel account or a parallel passage. Okay? Now, Do we need to look at the rest of these, or do we pretty much get the point? All right, so we do need to go to page 8. We'll be talking more about this example. Look at this one here. Chapter 21. This is a typo here, Mike. This should say 1 Samuel 21. Here.
Okay.
We need to change toward this to 21 in both spots.
It's on page 8.
It's on page 8, yeah. So, this is a famous one. Talking about Goliath and so forth. Slew the brother of Goliath the Hittite. In 1 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 5. Actually, Mike, the second one needs to stay. 1 Chronicles 25. The first one needs to be 2 Samuel 21, 9. Does that make sense?
21:9.
The second one can stay.
1 Chronicles
25 is correct. It's only the top one that I got wrong. So in First Chron, so notice what we got. So in 2 Samuel 20, verse 5, Bethlehemite slew the brother of Goliath the Hittite. Talking about Elhanan here, okay? So if we go to 2 Samuel
21:19.
What?
21:19.
So that was wrong?
Yeah.
Man, I'm making lots of mistakes. What's that?
Your screenshot lets you know what verse you're in.
Yeah. 21:19.
So I typed it wrong.
Yeah, you did.
Man, I should just retire.
No.
I should retire and let somebody else do this. Okay. So here we go. We'll end with this. Slew the brother of Goliath. So notice, slew, then the brother of, or in italics. Does everybody see that? So if I turn on the tools and we look at the interlinear, notice, come on. Why does nothing want to play nice today? There it is. Brother of. See, brother of is in a bracket and there's no what?
Corresponding.
There's no corresponding Hebrew words there. Okay? So let's go back to the notes. If we go to 1 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 5, notice that we have brother of and it's not in what?
Italics.
So let's go to 1 Chronicles 20. Now this particular one, this Chronicles one, is a hot potato one in the translation debate. We're not going to get into fully why that is right now because we're running out of time. I just want you to see the issues. 2 Chronicles, what's the verse number? 20, verse 5?
Yep.
1 Chronicles?
Yeah.
1 Chronicles, C H R O, right? N I C A L S.
C H R. All you have to do is C H R.
What?
C H R.
C L E S. There's no A in there.
There is now.
There is.
If everyone else can make up words, I can make up words.
C H R is all you have to put.
All right, here we are. After that took way too long. Notice the phrase here, this verse is in italics, the brother of.
No.
So if we go to the tools and we turn them on and we scroll down, okay, notice the brother, are there Hebrew words corresponding to this?
Yes.
The brother of Goliath, right? So are there Hebrew words corresponding to this?
Yes.
So what Scrivener is saying again is that in 2 Samuel 2019, 2119, you have italics in brother of, because there are no corresponding words in the Hebrew text.